On August 13th, 2012, 12 readers came to Writer House to share brief selections of their works. The event was emceed by Writer House member Polly Lazaron.
Stephanie Morris is a college sophomore who majors in something new every week. An inspiring writer of gothic horror and speculative fiction, and a voice actor. She lives south of Charlottesville in a hilltop castle haunted by hens, turkeys, two black pigs, and her very own Hound of the Baskervilles. Stephanie, you will read fiction.
All right, this is an excerpt from my short story, The Undoing of Persephone. A few days into spring break, Persephone's mother comes for a visit. Persephone calls herself Sophie now, has been since she started university. She's corrected her mother over the phone, she doesn't know how many times, but now she's wrestling her mother's suitcase through the door, and her mother, already in the room and fingering a sketch pad on the coffee table, says, "Persephone, what's this?" She's staring at the sketches that littered the first page, pressing a finger into the overdone detail of a pomegranate done in purple chalk. "It's private." Sophie abandons the suitcase and reaches for the sketch pad. Her mother glances at her, eyebrows raised. "It's my diary sketch thing." "Diary sketch thing," says her mother. "It's just stuff I see." Sophie slides the sketch pad from beneath her mother's finger and shoves it into the closet. "Around town, school, you know." Her mother says, "But you've never eaten pomegranates." "I have," Sophie snaps. She winces at the sharpness in her voice. Her mother stares at her. "I just meant I don't have to have eaten one to draw it." It's after this that Sophie notices the ladybugs. She catches sight of the first one, orange and black, creeping down the doorframe when she returns for her mother's suitcase. Her stomach clenches. She's lived half a semester in this apartment, and this is the first ladybug she's ever seen. She crushes it with the heel of her palm and scrubs her hand onto her jeans. But as she makes sandwiches for dinner, she keeps catching glimpses of ladybugs, flickers of orange and red and black in the corners between the refrigerator and microwave. Two ladybugs stroll up the window screen, another hunches beneath the lip of the sink where the metal isn't quite snug with the counter. Sophie tears a wad of paper towels from the roll and stamps through the kitchen, wiping up ladybugs and crushing them between her fingers. By the time she's finished with the sandwiches, the ladybugs have started to populate the unreachable areas. A cluster of shadows in the bowl of the hanging lamp, six or seven airborne, their wings tinkling, the light bulb throwing their shadows against the glass. They sound like crackling paper. Sophie runs from the kitchen with the sandwiches. The first thing she notices is her mother standing in the closet door, holding the sketch pad. Sophie says, "Mom!" And her mother looks at her. "Who is this?" she asks. Her voice is so soft that Sophie cannot read it. She can only read the way her mother's hands tremble as she holds up the sketch pad, open to Sophie's latest drawing. A man with a face as softly androgynous as a girl's, dressed in a boy's low-slung jeans, brooding among pomegranates. "Persephone, who is this?" "No one," Sophie says. "Mom, please put that back." Her mother is still for a moment, but she finally closes the sketch pad and throws it into the closet. By the time the women go to bed, there are cockroaches. Sophie listens to the whine of their wings until she falls asleep. Sophie awakes to the sound of a saxophone somewhere below the window of her room. She slips over to it, careful not to disturb her sleeping mother. She cannot see the saxophonist, but she knows what he looks like. Black cotton t-shirt hugging his slender body, black slacks and soft oxfords, newly washed hair curling at the nape of his neck. She thinks of him beside a fruit stand at the weekend farmer's market, his saxophone a murmur amid the hum of shoppers and sellers. She imagines the fruit stand, the older man seated in its shade, smiling into her shy curiosity. The saxophonist pausing in his song and saying, "Try the pomegranates, they're fantastic." She'd started at the sound of his voice. He'd smiled, put his lips back to the saxophone, and begun to play again. "Yes," said the seller. He gestured with a brown spotted hand to a row of plastic cups filled with pomegranate seeds, arrayed beneath the shade of his tent.
You want to try?
She had stared at the seeds, wondered what miracle had brought them here, fresh and blushing with red and purple health. She glanced at the saxophonist. He winked at her, gave her the slightest of nods. She had taken a sample, eaten it beside the fruit seller's stand, and when she'd finished, she bought two pomegranates. The fruit seller had grinned, thanked her. The saxophonist had paused again and said, "No going back now, huh?" "I love them," she said. "Yes," the smile again, "I thought you would." That night, Sophie is in a fever. She cannot stop drawing pomegranates. She cannot stop drawing the saxophonist, his hands around his saxophone, his smile, his beautiful, slender body wreathed in pomegranates.
Thank you, Stephanie. Amber Marley Padilla is the owner and principal of Pixel Fire Designs. When she's not working in the design studio, she can usually be found sculpting bronze or writing. Amber? And Amber's reading creative nonfiction tonight.
Okay, I'll be reading an excerpt from a memoir that I'm working on, and it's basically about 3 months of travel through Mexico and beyond with my teenage sister. So I'm kind of picking apart in the middle, and in this chapter, we're on a train. The train has just arrived in the border town of Nuevo Laredo, and my sister Jasmine and I find ourselves in front of the train station with two brothers that we met on the train. They were disguised as mechanics to avoid the Mexican police, the immigration police. Okay. This is called The Border. The four of us stood on the gritty sidewalk outside the station, silently wondering what to do next. The older mechanic shifted uncomfortably and suggested that we keep moving so as not to arouse suspicion. I hadn't thought of that, but I guessed he was right. We walked north and my mind was churning. A man in a suit called over, pointing to a sedan stalled in the middle of a side street. The mechanic waved Jasmine and me on ahead. It wasn't safe to wait there on the corner. We walked away, not knowing if we'd see them again. 3 blocks north, the border came into view, an ugly gash of fence and razor wire that separated us from them. A hotel sat 20 yards from the fence, square and brown. "We'll get a room and buy some time," I thought. The clerk stared from behind thick glass and bars and slipped us the key in a metal tray under the window. We passed a gauntlet of women who stared us down as we walked the long hallway. This was a different kind of place, and I felt bad for Jasmine seeing it. Our room was on the second floor. I locked us inside, 3 deadbolts and a chain, and stood there wondering what to do next. A plate glass window overlooked the wasteland of the border. The room was painted the green of morgue hallways, but the damp smell of disinfectant was comforting. There were 2 narrow beds, one by the door and the other by the window. The door to the bathroom was barred like a prison cell, and I was scared to go in it. Jasmine and I discussed the possibilities. I was pretty sure the brothers didn't have money. Jasmine brought it up first, although I must have been thinking it too. Could we please find a way to help them somehow? I argued against it, and the stubborn image of the mechanic's little girl, the smiling, dark-haired girl from the photo he'd showed me in the train vestibule, the girl from my dreams. The last thing I wanted was for something else to go wrong. We locked our bags in the room and walked 3 blocks south. Jasmine was talking, but I couldn't hear. I was testing things, weighing my responsibilities to her and myself against the dilemma of the 2 strangers. We found them there on the same street corner. They were finishing up, the car was running somehow, the businessman handing over a wad of pesos and shaking hands gratefully. They smiled when they saw us coming. "So you really are a mechanic," I said to the older one, the one that could talk. The younger one had pretended to be deaf mute on the train. They followed us back to the hotel, and when we walked past the wall of women, they seemed suddenly malignant, and the men playing dominoes in the dark end of the hallway seemed dangerous, too. I walked quickly, hoping to get to the room without any trouble. Up in the room, I laid out my old map. I'd been to Laredo a few times before and knew what a certain kind of traveler knows, the best stand for a gordita, a laundromat that accepts pesos and quarters, but I had no idea how to cross a river. While the brothers looked at the map, we learned that Mateo was the older one by a few years, and that Tio, the younger one, was possibly a little mad. He still hadn't spoken, and it seemed he had forgotten he was not really mute. Jasmine sat by the bed on the door. I checked the three locks and sat down beside her. Mateo excused himself to the bathroom, and soon we heard the shower running and steam smelling of Rosa Vina soap rolled from between the gaps in the bars. Tio sat on the bed near the window, looking at the floor and his hands in the window, which was glazed with dust and had the effect of being unpleasantly frosted. Tio's hair was woolly and unbrushed, and his tan overalls were mostly brown with dirt. For the first time, I realized that neither of them had a bag. When Mateo came out of the shower, he was wearing jeans and carrying the balled-up overalls, as if ashamed by their filth. I offered him a clean T-shirt and looked at him closely. His coarse hair was cut short, and his eyes were deeply creased at the corners. Jasmine spoke up. "They must be hungry. Let's invite them out. We can pay. You've still got pesos, right?" I remembered from paying for the room. I had 330 pesos, a week's worth of spending money in Mexico, if we were careful. The rest of my money was in traveler's checks, and the money for Alpine, Texas was safely in my bank account back home. "Are you hungry? Hambre?" I asked the brothers. They looked at each other the way Jasmine and I sometimes did, the close look between siblings that told me they would never admit to hunger. "I'll buy you dinner. Come on." The two of them talked for a minute, and when we got up to leave, Tio stayed behind, sitting in his spot on the bed, inspecting his hands. The three of us ate in a green-tiled lunchroom with formica counters, tacos soggy with Velveeta and canned salsa. Mateo told us they'd left Honduras 6 months before, stopping for a while to work in various cities, gradually making their way north. The last place they'd stayed was almost 800 miles south near Veracruz. We picked at our food, and he continued his story while I translated for Jasmine. "Things were going all right," he said. "Our boss let us sleep behind his house in an old bus. Man, the boss's mother loved me. She wanted me to marry one of her granddaughters and stay." "Why didn't you?" I asked. 2 days ago, the day we left, Tio and I were changing an engine. Something got into me. I've never quit anything, but I grabbed Tio from under the car and told him it was time to move." There was a long pause before he continued. "My boss's mother cried, asked me to stay. I told her I didn't come all this way to stop before seeing California. Our boss gave us the uniforms when we left. No one's going to bother a working man," he said. I thought of how Jasmine and I picked up and left Real de Catorce 2 days before, with nothing but a feeling I had to go north, but I didn't mention the coincidence. He spoke slowly so I could catch all the words. "We hitched north, but our ride got nervous and let us off before the Tampico checkpoint. We saw the train tracks beside the highway and hid, jumped on the first freight car that passed. We ended up in the train yard back in Monterey. I guess the station guard felt sorry for us. He gave us dinner and bought us 2 tickets. That was our first time on a passenger train. That's when I saw you with your map." "How will you get to California?" I asked. "I'll need a coyote." "Coyote?" Jasmine repeated. "Someone to show the way, a guide." "How will you find one?" I was full of questions. "This is the border. They're everywhere." Jasmine and I exchanged looks, and I knew what she was going to say. Jasmine had a way of complicating things. "Come on, please, let's give him a ride," she asked me in English. I hesitated, pushing the congealed Velveeta around on my plate. The image of the girl was right in front of me. "We don't even have room for them both," I said. "We'll take one of them then. We can't just leave them." I started stacking the dishes of half-eaten food. After a minute, I looked up at Mateo. "We have a truck," I said. "A camión." He looked confused, and I wondered if I was using the wrong word. I uncrumbled a napkin and drew my Mitsubishi pickup with tarp and tie-down straps and 2 stick-figure girls in the front seat. "But where? Aren't you backpackers?" "On the other side of the river, in Laredo." I paused, hoping to God I wasn't about to make a big mistake. "We have a camion with room for one of you," I said. "Paila," he said, pointing to the little truck, smiling the confident smile he had worn on the train during the long breakdown. "Paila," I repeated. I didn't ask which one of them would be coming with us or what would happen to the one left behind.
Thank you, Amber. Sigrid.
Is it me?
It's you, baby.
Okay.
Do you want to get a drink?
Yeah, sure. Okay.
Sigrid Mirabella believes it is with written words that she best defines and shares her heart. Her nonfiction and award-winning poetry have appeared in magazines, newspapers, and literary journals. Daytime, you will find her caring for the critters at the Almost Home Adoption Center in Nelson County. She's finishing a novel and a poetry book, and Sigrid's reading poetry tonight.
Thanks, Polly.
Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Before I start, if anybody wants a kitten, please see me after. I'm fostering some. Okay. This is from Doug's class, and some of us kind of know each other. And he gives us assignments that we can follow if we would like to sort of push us. But I can't remember what they all were for anymore. If I remember, I'll tell you. I'm going to start with one that actually was from one of the other classes, not the most recent one. And I better get my glasses. Okay. This is a little better. This is called... No, this is from this class, maybe. I don't know. Lost Opportunity Rainbow. Out of algae'd sky, clouds hang morbid, muffled, lightning, barely sparks, and thunder, harmless as an old dog too tired to growl, disappears into its own heat. Below, moist air plumped with pollen drips down winged sunflower stalks over snapdragon lips. Green humidity quells morning's radiant heart, bleeds her true colors into gradient neutrals. What a lost opportunity for sunshine to flare without hesitation, to light air into weightlessness, violet, crimson, orange, yellow, green, blue for pointless joy, a secret hope. And since that one was about morning, this one has moon in the title, so I'll go for that. Moonstruck. No longer the mortal black fox, my heart grows smaller, dabbles in faster beats and faster breaths, dumbfounds reshaping lungs. Erect fur, black and soft, spikes from my arched spine, admit the unstoppable change from canine to feline. Feet pulse with retractable claws, already legendary for blood. Comma-shaped nostrils flare at electrified wind. Fast feet pad clay returned as dust. Stop. Here, elliptical pupils consume stars. Moon-colored irises float in darkness. Caught in coarse grass, fireflies stare down nocturnal clouds. My cloven cat heart leaps away from vulpine paw prints, singularly tracked, following me, predator to predator. The moon also pursues. I throw head back, meowl my final transmutation, slink with trees and stones, brush into hushed horizon, changing each minute. And I'll go along with the whole thing. This is called Days. And actually, I remember this assignment was to have two stanzas that were very different, either in content or style. So this is Days, and it's spelled D-A-Y-S. Pure golden brilliance, birds tune their instruments, sky an unfluttered cerulean drape drop to horizon. First a brown and white striped chipmunk flits to center spotlight, then darts into high grass. Two small rabbits wink noses, cozy in green nest off to the wing. Where meadow meets grotto of trees, deer eat mulberry leaves and flick short tails. The youngest leap spontaneously, as if they cannot contain pent-up happiness. When a light wind comes in to tickle the valley, honeysuckle trumpets yawn delight, mimosa trees fan filigree-leaved approval. A small snake stops to taste new air, black scales sparkling like onyx and marcasite. Near the edge of sight, a red fox calmly licks sun-blazed fur, lips pulled back in contented submission. And where the lake is hidden from view, geese and ducks clap beaks, preen, and give gifts of feathers to float water. Slam the door, turn the key, jump in the car, turn the key, blast the radio, turn the knob, careless drivers, turn away, go to work, turn on phone, turn on smile, turn it off, turn, turn away, turn the day into the next and the next until no more the key falls. Okay. And this one goes with the others, kind of, sort of. This is called Grounding. When does an individual wake up one particular day, decide to eat crumbly loam, moist like cake on a plate, or finding red clay earth, dig up spoonfuls, swallow iron-laden mouthfuls to coat throat and esophagus into ceramic, fragile as unfired porcelain? In the morning, would this person consume rye seeds pulled up with lawn and dusty hunks trodden upon for months, years, eons, where neighbors exercised dogs, cats caught wild moles, dinosaurs strode, leaving bits of themselves? Imagine a woman salivating for stoneware as more delicious to eat than T-bone, red potato, and the spinach it holds. Mankind, as the potter beneath, carelessly sifts sand into waiting mouths who misunderstand what is sustenance and crunch between teeth that which will not crush. Yet in this fruitless gnashing, a belief in what is everlasting. Humus. And this is the last one. This is the one from a different class, actually, but it's one of Doug's. Highlight, and that's spelled I, capital I, hyphen, light, L-I-G-H-T. The moon is a searchlight in this thunderous night. I pull the pillow over my head to drown out silence, pretend that everything is all right. And imagine you kissing me, surrounding me with your arms. I believe nothing can crash through walls built to protect my small self curled against you. Yet moonlight exposes my open eyes and shadows beneath show. I am nothing more than myself in the eye of the moon. Thank you all.
Thank you, Sigrid. A native and resident of Scottsville, Lindsay Dorian, is a graduate of Trinity College, Connecticut and UVA. He served in Japan as a U.S. Army military intelligence officer. Lindsay practiced law in Central Virginia and served as Albemarle's first full-time Commonwealth attorney, director of the Virginia Department of Criminal Justice Services, and Scottsville District Albemarle County Supervisor. And he and his wife live in Scottsville. Lindsay's going to read creative nonfiction tonight. Lindsay, thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to read an excerpt from Howling the Dogs. It all started innocently enough. John Sawyer and I were working as lifeguards at Scottsville Pool in Central Virginia during the long, hot summer of 64. We were young and in college, and we ran the pool because it was one of the best jobs in the area. In August, we were burned. We were bored and ready for the summer to end. We had fought the sun for months, and the sun had won. Our tan bodies were proof of the long days of summer. The countless games of Red Rover, teenage romances, and family picnics. We were ready to go back to school, but as fate would have it, the summer did not end exactly as we planned, because the night in August caused me to change directions and worry less about the pool and more about our upcoming court date. In early August, I invited John to spend the night with me while my parents were away. We closed the pool at 9 p.m. and headed home in my car. The pool lay a short 5 minutes from my home. As we entered the driveway, John said, "Let's go howl Brillman's dogs." Brillman was an eccentric character whom I had heard complaining about pool about the kids waking up his dogs on a regular basis. Billman was determined to do something about it. I had never howled dogs, I had heard about it. The sport was for guys to drive by Brillman's house and dog kennels at night, and an able-bodied male would be released from the car on the back country road and transform himself into a full-pitch hunting dog, squatting on the ground and raising his head as high, in a high, mournful sound, until all of Brillman's hunting dogs joined in, creating a god-awful noise that sometimes lasted all night long. For some time, Brillman had been trying to catch the culprits, and he often chased them in his pickup truck, never catching them. Brillman had talked to me about it. He would laugh his loud, full-bellied laugh as he was determined to catch the rascals who were raising hell with his dogs. It was sport for both parties. Youngsters trying to upset Brillman and Brillman trying to catch the culprits. But the barking dogs making a great racket, creating long, sleepless nights for Brillman. He enjoyed the hunt, though, always coming close to his prey, but never quite catching them. Brillman was a large, robust man who climbed trees for a living. He liked a good joke and a good laugh as much as he liked climbing trees, and the sport of howling his dogs was a challenge to him that he readily accepted. Brillman knew he could put a stop to it if he just hung in there. The whole town knew about howling Brillman's dogs and got a kick out of it. Brillman's eccentric behavior and general good humor made him the perfect target. I didn't know who was howling Brillman's dogs, but I wasn't surprised when John brought it up. John was always living on the edge. Although only 19 years old, he drank beer often before and during, after pool work hours. He was always looking for ways to keep life exciting, mostly doing harmless, mischievous things only John would do. Howling dogs fit the John Stowe mode of raising hell without getting caught and making a fool out of someone in the process. That hot August night, the last thing I wanted to do was go howling Brillman's dogs. But John was persistent. Lindsay, all you have to do is drive down there to let me out. Then pick me up after I howl the dogs. We'll be home in 5 minutes. No, I don't want to do it, I said. Look, this may be your only chance to do this. I will do all the work. All you have to do is drive. Billman's home was only half a mile away, and I began to rationalize that this trip would be short and sweet, that John would do all the howling and we would be home back home quickly. John was having his nightly beer and it was dark and he was ready to roll. Against my better judgment, I got into the car and we started out. I drove down Burman's Road, a dirt road called Mountain Vista Road. The road ran down below the dog pens, which were located on a high hill. I stopped in the road bottom near the creek, and John got out and ran up the road just below the dog pens. I heard John howl, a loud, mournful howl. Woo! 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 Then he came running back, jumped in the car and said, "Get the hell out of here, Grillman's coming." I saw the truck lights coming down the hill and around the corner as I shot out of the parking area and roared up the hard surface of Route 20. I cut off into a hidden driveway where I learned, turned around and parked and let Broman go by. I found out later that the town sergeant's house was directly across from where I parked. And the sergeant was motioning to Broman in the direction of my car. I saw Broman's headlights coming up the hill. Instead of continuing down the road past that dark, motionless vehicle, Broman turned directly into a hiding spot. I started the car, turned on the lights, and shot out of the driveway. This time I sped down Route 20 and headed to my house. We sped up the driveway, ran into the house, and jumped into our beds, turning off all the lights. We saw the headlights of Broman's truck come turn into our driveway and creep up the road. Broman stopped the car at our car. He got out and felt the car's hood. He then came to my house, knocked on the door, and called for my father. We hid upstairs, and when no one answered, Broman soon left the door, got in his truck, and drove away. We thought we had escaped until about 2:30 a.m., when I was looking out the bedroom window, and a police car came rambling up our driveway. Alamo Deputy Sheriff M. Higginsby Rose showed up the house and knocked on the door. I went down, John stayed in bed, and Officer Higginsby stood at the front door and said, "Are you Lindsay Daria? Come and sit in my car." I followed him to the patrol car and got in the back seat where I saw Broman in the front passenger seat. Broman had proceeded to tell the officer what he'd seen. He told him I drove the car and John Starr howled the dogs. And Officer Higginson said he would go a lot easier for me if I told him everything. I figured cooperation was the best thing for me at that point, so I told the officer and Broman everything. Broman asked me who else had been involved in the howling of the dogs. I mentioned every boy I could think of. I came up with 7 other names. I thought this would get me out of trouble, but instead it sunk me in deeper. After confessing for an hour and bringing in every boy in the neighborhood, Officer Higginson said I could leave. I got disgusted and went upstairs to my room. John was asleep. And I cussed him for this mess we were in and then went to bed. The next morning, we went back to the pool. At about 11 o'clock a.m., Officer Higginson drove up to our squad in the squad car. He called me over and I got into the back seat. He then proceeded to serve me with a warrant, charging me with disturbing the peace, a class 1 misdemeanor. John was served and we glumly went about the pool duties that day. The next thing I heard was a call from Paul Willie, a neighbor, said he had been served with a warrant and asked me if I knew anything about the case. I told him I had a warrant and asked what his plans were. He said he planned, he and the others, planning meeting with the lawyer, Bill Brown, get ready for court. I said I would join him and the others at Brown's house. We met with Brown in the afternoon. There were seven boys charged with disturbing the peace. My parents were upset with me and with them. I wondered how I could have done such a dumb thing. I went to see Brillman and offered to do work around his place if he would drop the charges. Brillman said, no, I'll see you in court. The court hearing came several weeks later for Judge Hitty, the old juvenile judge who was known to have a drinking problem. The day of the hearing, my mother and I went to court, which was filled with young people and not their parents. The case before ours was one involving a kid urinating in a bush in the lady's yard. I remember the lady saying to the youngster was killing her plants, and the kid's defense was that he was drinking beer and couldn't hold it. The judge found the youngster guilty and sentenced him to jail and community service, tending plants in the park. Our case was called next, and Attorney Brown came up and told the judge that we were just young boys, and no one had seen any of us disturbing the peace. He argued that none of us disturbed anything. He quoted Blackstone in a case from 17th century England, which required criminal intent for the finding of guilt. Even if we did what was alleged, this was not disturbing the peace, since the dogs were making the noise, not us. The dogs may have been disturbing the peace, but we were not. And no one could connect any sounds, loud sounds, to our individual behavior. In fact, no one, not even Brillman, could link up the sound with a specific defendant. Without a confession, the Commonwealth could not prove his case. I remember that Judge Hetty nodded off several times. He generally looked out of it. At the end of the case, he said, does anyone have anything good to say about these boys? No one stood. Finally, my mother stood and said, Judge, this would not have happened if we'd been home that night. Linz is a good boy, but if we'd been home, he would not have gone out later that night. There were no other persons who stood up, and Judge Kennedy said, I'll take this case under advisement, and swept the warrants into his desk drawer. The warrants never reappeared. I went off to college after the hearing and never heard anything more about the warrants in the case. John Starr joined the Merchant Marines and traveled the world. After spending years at sea, John docked at a port in the Balkans, and he went aboard a Russian ship, play poker, and vanish. Weeks later, his body was found floating in the bay where the ships docked. John always lived on the edge and was known to carry large sums of money with him. The night he went to play poker, John probably thought he was invincible. I had many fond memories of John, and we enjoyed many a good time together. And I would miss him. I later became a prosecutor in the court where I was tried. The last days of summer '64 taught me a few things. I learned about trying to please everyone and land a person in trouble. I also learned that one should pick his associates carefully, since one's friendship and association with the wrongdoer puts them in the same pot, and no amount of explanation can lay the divorce to two. I also heard how a good defense lawyer can save the day and had a sleepy judge to still make the right decision. We saw justice that day, and we left the court. As we left the courtroom, I remember hearing Billman's loud laughter after he and Officer Higginby shared another story together. I never had any more trouble with Billman's dogs.
Gary Hoffman, a native of Richmond and graduate of the university, is the author of the Parent-Student College Agreements, available on Amazon eBooks, and the forthcoming series, The Real Cost of College, An avid cyclist, Gary reads tonight from The Bike, a recent nonfiction essay. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you. I knew Lindsay was going to be a hard act to follow, so I brought a prop. See if that'll stay up there. Actually, I've retitled the piece. Call it The Wheel Sucker. I had trouble with my gearing that hot and hilly day in Cherokee Park in Louisville, Kentucky. I was 24 years old, a virtual newbie, and without professional support at the 110-mile U.S. National Bicycle Road Race Championships. I'd foolishly been lubricating my shift levers the night before the race, and my gears would skip, especially when I would accelerate rapidly. It was too late for me to do anything about it by the time I discovered my blunder at the starting line. I knew then that I couldn't take the accelerations that were sure to come from the main group, so at my first opportunity, I went off the front for a chance to be in a breakaway group that might work cooperatively for the majority of the race. On a twisty road, turn in the road, I did sneak away, out of the sight, and joined up with one other opportunistic rider. The next thing I knew, four members of the U.S. national team joined up with us. This was surely to be the winning breakaway, and I was in it. With close to 80 miles to go, we all set out to work cooperatively to maintain our increase our lead over the main field. We each took our turn at the front, pushing hard into the wind, then sliding so gently to the side to form a secondary and slower line, drifting to the back. If you've ever observed geese flying in formation, that's what it's like. It has the rhythm of dance, smooth, subtle movements, wheels and elbows only inches away from each other, but with more force to the pedal when you're on the front in order to keep the speed up. It's called an echelon, and the idea is to, as a group, go as fast as you possibly can, equally sharing the workload, your maximum effort lasting only for about 20 seconds at the front. Then you slide off to the side in the slower line, resting a bit, gradually finding your way to the back, then moving over to the other line, which is the line going faster, until you find yourself back at the very front again. So we did this, pace line, five of us working in concert, maintaining the speed up and down the rolling hills, riding in the smoothest and most powerful breakaway group that I'd ever been in for over 75 miles. The intensity and concentration was trance-like. As we moved through time and space at the highest rate of speed possible, keeping the rhythm, yet inches apart, working as one for the common goal of staying away from the group of 100 angry and determined riders trying to chase us down, the perfect echelon. And it was 100 degrees and I wasn't drinking. My family and friends were there yelling, but I hadn't been listening. I was so intent on keeping my place in line, staying on the wheel in our tight formation without overlapping, otherwise we would crash. Eventually, as the magnitude of the effort, the heat, and my lack of fluids began to take its toll, I started to crack. Then I realized, finally, why there was so much shouting and screaming every time, every lap I went by the feeding area. It wasn't just shouts of encouragement. I needed water badly, and I hadn't been drinking. Once I realized the magnitude of my mistake, it was too late. I was light in the head and wasn't thinking clearly. My frantic attempt to get bottles of water in the feeding zone to right my dehydration and heat-induced trauma, a gap opened between me and my four breakaway allies. But there was one other rider. I knew he was there, but I had blocked him out of my mind. He came to my attention now, Jim Okowitz. Jim had been sitting on our group the entire time, following the group in the shelter of the wind without getting in line and without partaking in the shared work at the front to keep us fast. He hadn't been doing any work whatsoever, and now he was behind me. Somehow, at that instant, my mind lapsed back to a key race where I had been forced to either work or get dropped. In my dazed consciousness, I rewound back to that primal, instinctive place in my brain. I was intent on protecting my breakaway companions to get rid of the wheel sucker. So instinctively, I let a gap open up. It got bigger, and bigger, and Akowitz was still on my wheel as I looked over my shoulder. "I'm not going to close that gap for you. You've been sitting on the entire race," I said. "You're going to have to do it yourself." Jim was a sprinter, a member of the U.S. Olympic track team. If it came to a sprint and he was there, he would surely win. The gap continued to grow. "I'm serious. I'm not going to close that gap. If you're going to stay with us, you have to work," I said emphatically. He blasted back, "I can't. I can't do anything. I'm barely hanging on." At this point, the gap had grown to such dangerous proportions, whether he was telling the truth or not, it was time for me to do something. So I accelerated away as best I could without skipping my gears, leaving Akowitz behind, who immediately pulled over and quit the race. Now I was tasked with catching up with four of the top riders in the country, all national team members in the winning breakaway in the national championship, with less than 20 miles to go. They were collectively trying to go as fast as they could, and I had to go even faster to catch them. And I did get close enough so I could clearly see the tread on their back tires, and I imagined regaining contact with just one final effort. With only a few bike lengths to reach my goal, the road pitched uphill along with my final surge to close the gap. Then my gear skipped badly and I slammed down into my seat from my standing position. I had forgotten how bad the gearing problem was, and now it was too late. I was powerless to do anything else. This opportunity was forever lost as I watched the winning breakaway, at first slowly, pull away, and then, more quickly, disappear out of sight down the road. I have a picture to remind me of my lost opportunity that day. Today it sits in my den where I write. That photo teaches me a lot about myself and my life journey. There are many lessons that inspire and carry me. Preparation, opportunity, and drinking plenty of water when it's 100 degrees. But what draws me the most is the power of the group united as one. And maybe, just maybe, not to worry so much about those tagging along for the ride.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you. Our next reader is Ron Harris. Ron is a retired computer programmer from the Northeast. He lives on a farm in Fluvanna County where he trains dogs. And Ron's going to read fiction. Thank you, Ron. That's your bio.
Oh, I guess I did write that. Okay, come on. This is a chapter from a mystery novel in progress. Sergeant Mike Schaefer is head of the police canine unit in Westlake, an imaginary university town in upstate New York. It is not the University of Virginia. In this book, Mike leads the investigation of several murders that follow the rape of a co-ed. In this scene, we are in the police station on Saturday, November 9th, 1996. "God, I hate homecoming," Officer Teresa Kane stood by Mike's desk at the end of the 4 to midnight shift. "Fucking drunk alumni. Foot patrol on the riverfront esplanade is the worst. I mean, who hits on a cop in uniform? Was it always this bad? Don't think so. But then, upstate used to win more. Is this a lead into back when I played? Ancient history. Moving to current events, how is the marathon? Personal best. I beat 3:15 and placed top 20 in my age group. Had a great time hanging with friends in the Apple. Congratulations, what's next? A triathlon in the Keys in January, so I better get back in the pool for some serious work. Just then, the rookie in charge of the lockup rushed over, followed by a short, overweight female sheriff's deputy. Sergeant Schaefer, we got a situation downstairs. What? We got 8 guys sobering up and holding, and one of them's got warrants. The deputy is here to transport him to the jail, but he won't come out. What do you mean, he won't come out? I told him to come to the door to cuff up. He flipped out and grabbed one of the other prisoners. He's threatening to break his neck if we come in there. Well then, maybe you should call the cops. Mike looked around, then pointed at the rookie's badge. Oh, wait a minute. We are the cops. The deputy tried to be helpful. Should I call the jail for the cell extraction team? Mike stood up. Or maybe the FBI HRT? Jesus Christ, it's just a drunk. Kane, go with them and make sure this doesn't get out of hand. I'll be with you in a minute. Kane said, I thought you weren't cleared for full duty. Technically. I see the doctor Tuesday, but it's been almost 10 weeks. Cracked ribs are supposed to heal in around 6. Just wait for me downstairs. Mike went to his truck and let Ike out. Vacation's over, buddy. Time to do a little police work. The big, sable German Shepherd gave him a look he interpreted to mean, about time, and trotted over to the bushes at the back of the lot to leave P-mail for the rest of the local dogs. Let's go. Mike hooked up a traffic leash and headed back inside. They descended to the basement and stopped at the heavy steel door leading to the lockup. Mike whispered to Ike, speak. Ike barked 3 times. He stopped when Mike stroked him gently between the ears. The rookie opened the door. He eyed Ike warily and made sure to keep Mike between himself and the dog. Mike stopped in front of the men's holding cell. Ike sat on his left as they faced the drunk and disorderly detritus of Upstate's first home victory this season. The ventilation system was not keeping up, so the air reeked. 2 prisoners were passed out on the bench along the back. 4 others huddled on the bench to Mike's left, watching the action. A beefy guy, Mike estimated to be a few inches taller than his 6 feet, and outweigh him by at least 50 pounds, stood in the middle of the cell holding his hostage in front of him, with his right arm wrapped around the terrified man's neck. Mike smiled and said, Tom, that's your name, right? Tom, what seems to be the problem? I ain't done nothing but have a few beers, and the kid and the fat broad want to put me in prison. You let me go, or I'll break Puke Breath's neck. I'll make you a deal. You come along peacefully, and we'll forget about this. If it's some kind of mix-up, the sheriff will straighten it out over at the jail. What do you say? Fuck you. I ain't going nowhere but home. I'm telling you, you really don't want to do this the hard way. Mike looked at the rookie. Officer, I can bring him out, but you got to clean up after. The rookie said, what are you talking about? Kane said, guess you've never seen what a canine can do. Big bloody mess. Mike turned back to the drunk tank. So, what's it going to be? Eat shit and die, asshole. His voice still friendly and reasonable, Mike said, your choice, your funeral. He knelt next to Ike and pointed. Ike, see the big ugly guy in the blue sweatshirt with the orange paint on his face? Under his breath, he whispered, speak. Ike barked twice, stopping on Mike's signal. His bark was deafening, echoing off the concrete walls. We need you to bring him out of there, understand? 2 more barks. Tom, if you read our local paper, you know about the last guy Ike subdued. Officer Kane, how long was he in the hospital? 5 days before they took him to jail. Kane turned her back to the cell so Tom couldn't see her laughing. I already called the EMTs. Tom looked a little less certain, but he said, I ain't afraid of Rin Tin Tin. All righty then. Rook, you open the door on 3. Officer Kane, make sure the rest of these citizens behave. Ready? He cued Ike to bark again. He stood up and pulled back gently on Ike's collar so that the dog's opposition reflex made him strain forward. Tom's head swiveled back and forth as if he were looking for a place to hide. Mike had to shout to be heard over Ike. 1, 2, Tom let go of his hostage and raised his hands. Okay, okay, I give up.
Thank you, Ron. Jackie Lazo. As a newcomer to Charlottesville from Southern California, Jackie is fascinated by farm life. She has a bit of a black thumb. Sadly, her potatoes and lettuce never sprouted. So she splits her time between writing her first nonfiction book and daydreaming about owning a miniature dog, a miniature donkey. Jackie?
Thank you.
In honor of all of the storms that I've experienced here, which are quite intense, unlike any I've seen before, I'm going to read a piece about spending, it's a nonfiction piece, about spending the summers in Connecticut and watching the summer storms. I am always waiting for the storm to come, across the sound, riding the water like a boat, sails splayed. When the weather starts to mount, I slide into the antique rocking chair on the enclosed porch. Pushing off the stone-colored carpet, my toes and the balls of my feet tap with the same force I give the ground when I swing on the old apple tree's branch out back. The tree's bough bends and arcs the same way the bowed wood underneath me does. I watch the Connecticut late summer sky. It is petulant as a child stomps before the erupting tantrum. Storms always race across the sound faster here than anywhere else. The heightening stillness in the air catches my breath, yanks it away. My grandfather spreads the puzzle pieces out across the circular game table, separating the luminous greens from the muddy eggshell, the cerulean blue. The puzzle is of an English countryside landscape. Three sheep, glowing white as if lit on fire in the summer's late afternoon blaze as it dashes across a field. White speckled on green, sheep on land. My grandfather clears his throat. I stay my position, waiting for the sky to break. The storm is almost to the cobblestone bridge. Then it will ride across the pond, tossing plump raindrops like emptied baskets of beads on the lawn. My grandmother enters. The fan starts to whir. She nestles herself in the couch, Vogue and Southern Living perched in her lap. She is drenched in peony fabric, sharp pinks and green tendrils jutting up from the backs and the arms and the seat of the couch to cushion her. She is sinking into her garden, poised in peonies so loud she doesn't hear the approaching thunder roar. She's used to petulant weather. I cherish it, taste the clean, wet asphalt flat against my lips. As the thunder yawns, I begin to count. 1-1,000, 2-1,000, 3-1,000, 4, lightning again. This time striking a 300-year-old oak across the pond. A crack, the earth's ankle breaking. The treetop limbs are ablaze, coughing up smoke. The oak goes golden white as it blisters. I push off the floor, arching back in the smooth wooden chair. The storm has split. I feel the edges of my lips curl up. It is exactly as I had imagined, explosive and raw.
Fred Mouse teaches music theory and music history and loves his work. He's lived in Charlottesville since 1990. Fred reads in many different genres, listens to many kinds of popular and classical music, cooks from fresh ingredients every day. Where do we sign up? And that's not in the bio. And enjoys visiting cities, especially Mexico City, London, Paris, Liverpool, Washington, D.C., Baltimore, and New York. Fred?
Thanks. I had to miss a class of Avery's seminar this summer, and Avery said, "That's okay, just bring back some impressions from your trip." So I did, and that's the origin of what I'll read tonight. In July, I leave Charlottesville for a few days, traveling to Berlin for an academic conference, where scholars, mainly from Germany or the United States, share ideas about the art of listening. When I arrive, I find that the conference takes place in a newly renovated industrial building right next to the river, the old brick walls filled in with elegant modernist spaces intended for innovative performances, the shapes and colors of the rooms simple and neutral. A spacious ground floor terrace offers a perfect view of the river, as do balconies and large windows at other levels of the six-story building. Commercial tourist boats float by, neither slow nor fast, their decks filled with rows of seats as though for a performance by Berlin itself. Across the river, there are industrial buildings, much like the one we are in, box-like red brick structures. But the windows are all broken. Huge, bright-colored graffiti cover the walls. Tall weeds surround the buildings. The sky above is enormous, and it changes constantly, a new cloudscape every time you look. Though not involved in the conference, my boyfriend Teko is with me, and we find time to explore. Neither of us has been in Berlin before. Fortunately, we both love long walks. On our first evening in Berlin, Teko and I walk for hours in the Tiergarten, a huge park in the center of the city. It's summer, and we are in northern Europe. The gentle yellow sunlight lasts till 10 p.m. The park is mostly woods, with wide, winding gravel paths. The tall, round, deciduous trees offer sweet, calm shelter. The park is completely different from the dense, rangy forests closely packed with competing pine and cedar trees back home in Virginia. It's quiet. We hear only the rustle of leaves, an occasional voice speaking or laughing, traffic sounds as we approach a road. As we walk, I imagine that we are somewhere very old, the curves of the trees offering to share a rich wisdom ripened over many years. Later I learn that the area was devastated by World War II bombing. The serene park, like so much in Berlin, is a post-war reconstruction. There are surprises in the woods. Emerging from a shady path, we find ourselves in a big, bright meadow with a few scattered boulders. The meadow and stones are a work of art. Someone arranged the stones carefully in the open space, and they are partly carved and polished. We learn from a sign that the stones come from all over the world, and by some process I do not understand, every year on June 21st, they draw together many points around the globe through the action of reflected sunlight. Teko and I play like children, lying on our backs on medium-sized bench-like stones to look at the sky, then leaning back against polished surfaces twice our height, posing for a few silly pictures. The stones in space make up a monument that has nothing to do with the German Empire, the Third Reich, or the Cold War. This benevolent monument says, "You are here, at this particular place, related to various other places on the Earth." It's as though the stones are smiling at us with a goofy New Age tranquility. Across the street, outside the park, screened from us by trees, a vast, mysterious array of coffin-like stone rectangles, silent except for sounds from the adjacent street, commemorates the Holocaust. We don't notice the Holocaust monument on our first visit to the Tiergarten, but a few days later we watch some visitors wandering among the cold blocks. A few children try to play in the narrow paths, a half-hearted hide-and-seek, but the gray stones are cheerless. Across the street from the Holocaust Memorial, back in the Tiergarten, nestled in its own small clearing, is a memorial to homosexuals persecuted under Nazism. It looks like a big gray concrete box or a small gray building, an ambiguous mismatched continuation of the other memorial. You can look inside the box through one small window, and you see a short black and white film of same-sex couples kissing. Like a closet, the monument shelters these kisses and imprisons them. As we take turns peering in the window, a young straight couple walks by, not visiting the monument, but just passing through the clearing. We ask them to take a picture of us, standing in front of the monument. They agree without enthusiasm, and they depart promptly after taking three shots. Teko checks the pictures. "You look so serious," he exclaims. "Well," I tell him, "it's a Holocaust memorial." Sure enough, I have the solemn, mournful expression that I evidently considered appropriate for the location. My face says, "Isn't homophobia awful? Terrible things have happened." But in the same snapshots, Teko, gazing warmly at the camera, has a relaxed smile, calm and charming. They are odd pictures. Teko has been living with me in Charlottesville, but it's not clear how long that will last. There are various reasons, but for one thing, the laws are not on our side. Teko is from Mexico. There he had a good job, but here in Virginia he is on a tourist visa and cannot work. Every time he leaves the United States and wants to come back, he might be turned away. But in Berlin, as he stands in the sun next to a grim gray memorial, his face says, "We don't know what will happen next, but today is a beautiful day."
As a new member of Writer House, started taking Rose Elliott's poetry class this spring and continued on into the summer session. Lucia has lived in Luray since 1993, and perhaps gets the award for the longest distance traveler to attend their workshops, and has been a member of a small writers group there for more than 6 years. She looks forward to commuting to Seville for more classes at Writer House. And Lucia is offering luscious, luscious cantaloupes to anyone.
I think there's one left. There's one's for Rose.
Oh.
How many left are there?
There's one.
Can I have it?
Yes.
Okay. I'm claiming it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Colin. I'm going to read two poems. Both of these were class assignments that Rose gave us. Both of the poems that I'm going to read are around a theme that I'm hoping to continue working on. The first is an assignment to write a poem about our mother's or our grandmother's kitchen. I think Rose gave us a couple of stipulations. One, it had to have something green in it. And two, it had to have something dead in it. I'm not sure that I followed the directions, but this is the poem. And it's called A Southern Comfort Kitchen. The kitchen was late 50s perfect, turquoise trim and light gray Formica counters, a modern gas stove, big fridge, double sink, dishwasher. Cooking owned 2/3, my father's bar commanded the other. A counter, its hulking protrusion, divided that room. Cabinets loomed low, holding dishes decorated in chicken privative for breakfast and lunch on weekends at noon. Walls and cupboards whispered a patterned history we could not hear above the tumbling ice, revealed what we could not see reflected in glasses for highballs and martinis. Next to the bar sink, 3 jars, olives, small pearls, sweet red cherries, speared through their hearts on nights our parents were not scotch on the rocks with a splash of water. My mother's hands were white with silence, her surrogate, tender and wrinkle-worn quiet, our brown-skinned mother who cooked all our favorites, fried chicken, white rice, with dark gravy, who cleaned bed sheets, clothes, and our souls, who anchored a stool near that counter to listen as we came home from school, a woman whose history we never knew, whose name we could not pronounce, whose lap we could always curl into, Juju in her gray uniform, white trim, and apron. This second poem I'm going to read is also in that series. It was also an assignment. And the assignment was to write a persona poem, which, as you know, is a poem written from another person's point of view. It's in the theme that I'm working on. And the title of it is called Baptism. Baptism. On the beach, oat grass dunes lean towards warm Gulf waters. Small white hands grip mine, urging first steps onto skin-searing sand. Their mother, not far behind, toting beach towels and cream. My skin stark against white sand sky, skirt billowing, darkening as I wade into depths of children's joy. My makeshift suit grows heavy, feet unsure. Shallow wet sand squeezes beneath my tired toes. Water rises, cooling to mid-thigh. Waves break slowly into memory. Diamonds sparkle as far as I can see. My kin, four sisters, two brothers, by a still small pond. Here, three nymphs cling to my skirt for safety as crashing waters threaten. In brightest light, this ritual each day, they chant, "Baptize us, Juju, baptize us." I wonder what God intends. My feet buried firm in the sand sea floor, my body bowed but steady. Delicate in my cradling arms, I dip her down, skimming water's glimmering silk, as I baptize in the Father's name. A second deeper dip in the name of the Son, her two sisters squealing with wide-eyed wonder. She rolls on the crest of the next gentle wave. I chuckle. Her nose pinched by little fingers, eyes closed tight, a swift gesture in the name of the Holy Ghost, full submersion, a saltwater bath of laughter. They sleep in the cottage above, their pale skin pink and warm, fanned by dark air from the sounding sea. My plain room and bath with breezes blocked, black starless night of my quarters, framed among pilings sunk in deep dry sand. I bend my knees down, asking God why, and pray for the children I can never have. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisha. Rachel Quinby was born in upstate New York and got the heck out as soon as she could. She's now a public radio producer and, though never married, serves proudly as chief interviewer for DivorceCamp.com.
So this is an excerpt from a piece I wrote about my time in France working on an organic farm. It's in the form of an email, and it's called Le Chèvre and I. Dear friends, I'm writing to you after a fabulous weekend in Toulouse, La Ville Rose. Think of it as the Atlanta of France, in that both cities have airports and inscrutable accents. Anyway, what a great place. It's got medieval architecture, a university, markets, festivals, and plenty of Maison du Kebab. My God, the shawarma. I'm sorry to report, however, that my quest for La Vie Bohème was sabotaged by an inexpensive Best Western near La Rue Saint-Pierre. I'll stick it to the man after I use his free Wi-Fi. In preparation for my return to the farm of famine, I ate as much as I possibly could in Toulouse, and then, sadly, lost it all on the train platform. Au revoir, mes croissants. Food has become a bit of an issue since I last wrote. My farmer host dad, Guillaume, and his endlessly patient wife, Dominique, kindly acknowledged my lame attempts to explain in my broken, jet-lagged French that Jews don't eat the pigs or of the fish without little fish arms for swimming? Not without that. But, like an ignorant American, I forgot to tell them no snails, no frogs, no squid, and no rabbits. I don't think my dictionary has an entry for cloven hooves anyway. So at least twice a week at their main midday meal, while they eat pieces of the pig formerly known as Gigi, I have to gnaw away at the midsection of a bunny. Its kidneys are always still attached, and I know I should be grateful for the extra protein, but I can't stomach them. So they sit there on my plate like a science experiment until Guillaume clears the table and pops them into his mouth. Then, to add insult to injury, we all eat salad greens. The state of not understanding what the hell anyone is saying has become less of a problem as I learn more amusing French-English homophones like bra, arm, and B-O, meaning organic, pronounced B-O. Sometimes, though, Sometimes, though, I get so eager to make a complete picture from the linguistic particles I understand that I come to quick and ludicrous conclusions. Par exemple, the one thing Guillaume knows about me is that I'm Jewish. The one thing I know about Guillaume is that he doesn't speak English. We are not natural conversation pals, and yet, this afternoon, he decided to probe a little deeper. Picture, if you will, Guillaume sitting on a log surrounded by chickens. He says, Rachel, do you know much about the deportation of French Jews during World War II? Me, cuddling a Gascon hen. Yes. Well, no, not very much knowing, but yes. Sad shame. Frowns buffoonishly. Guillaume, it is very sad, and yet some say Hitler was unstoppable. At this point, I hear him say éclair, meaning lightning, instead of Hitler, meaning Hitler. Me, panic silence. Huh, that finds me interested. Lightning? I guess war can strike quickly and bombs fall from the sky like lightning. Think, Rachel, think. Slowly, pointedly. Alas, war is lightning of the spirit, of course. But maybe I was okay during the war, because though I am a Jew, I am very short. And I heard that the people who are small are cut, you know, broken, battered by lightning much after the people who are tall. Guillaume. Huh? Hitler? He draws a swastika in the air. Rachel? Yes, lightning draws pointy zigzags in the air. Guillaume? Adolf Hitler? Rachel? Oh! Relieved laughter. Yes, Adolf Hitler, yes! Looks angry, holds right arm straight out. Hitler, yes! Ha 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 ha! Yes, Hitler! Oh, so funny. Well, not the man, for certain. No, for certain. But my ears, ha 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 ha! Guillaume excused himself to spread compost over the lettuce beds. I miss you guys. Send snacks. Ton ami, Rachel.